Good afternoon. Welcome to today's meeting of the House Resources Committee. Time is, looks like 13:01. Members present include Representative Seaton, Representative Tarr, Representative Olson, Representative Tuck, Representative Hawker, Co-Chair, what's your name, Sadler? Yeah. Co-Chair Sadler, myself, Co-Chair Feige. Representative Johnson is excused, and I assume Representative Wilson will be coming shortly. Today we have an overview presentation from the, and we've been joined by Representative Wilson. We have an overview presentation from the Department of Natural Resources. Commissioner Dan Sullivan is here to update us on the state of his department. And he's brought, he's brought all his division heads and deputies, and the whole cast of characters is here. So with that, Commissioner Sullivan. Yeah, if you guys want to come up, and I don't think he really needs to hold your hand, but
oh, I do.
I see from the newspapers this weekend the Marine Corps is alive and well on the streets of Anchorage, foiling bank robberies and everything else. So,
yes, sir, Mr. Chairman, for the record,
was he one of yours?
No, sir, but you know we're all brothers, so I consider him one of mine. For the record, my name is Dan Sullivan. I'm the Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources, and I have with me at the table Deputy Commissioner Joe Balash and Deputy Commissioner Ed Fogles. So thank you for that shout out to one of Alaska's finest there, a young Marine, stopping a bank robbery in progress. So we're all very proud of him. And great to see our young people with the guts to take those kind of actions. But so with your permission, sir, what we plan on doing is going through the overview. And I first wanted to start out by just saying it's a pleasure to be here. This obviously in the House is our number one committee with regard to what we do. And what we wanted to do today, importantly, as part of our overview testimony, was essentially bring the entire DNR leadership team here, so there's kind of eyes on, faces to names, get a sense of what everybody's been doing in the department. And we did this last year. We thought it worked well. It is something that we've talked about, and DNR is really, really critical to what we're focused on, is being responsive, respectful, and in terms of our work with the legislature. And what we wanted to do today was demonstrate that, and hopefully some of our committee, or our director of the different divisions, will also be meeting with different representatives. So the goal of the overview, as I mentioned, Mr. Chairman, is first to introduce the team. And hopefully you'll agree with me. We think we have a great team here. They're almost all present and accounted for. Do a quick kind of just update on their divisions, a little bit of accomplishments over the course of the last year. As you know, it's a big agency, so we'll keep that brief. And then what we thought we would do is touch on really a year in review, kind of the main part of our briefing. We'll try and get through that fast, but the real goal is to focus on areas really since the last legislative session. There's been a lot of work, and keep that at the high levels in areas that we think this committee is most particularly interested in. We have a few handouts. I think you have the PowerPoint brochure that's in the Oil and Gas magazine that relates to some of the work that we've been doing. And to those of you who have seen some of these materials before, I know you have, Mr. Chairman. Our apologies. We do cover a lot of ground, but we think it's important to have the whole committee, particularly this committee, have an update and an overview. So, and then finally, we'll touch on at the end kind of the year ahead, some of the issues in the legislative session that have already been introduced by the governor that are going to be a lot of the focus of our leadership team, but certainly this committee. And I will say at the outset, one thing you'll see hopefully through the presentation is in DNR the sense of optimism that we have. We certainly know that the state has challenges. Our optimism, though, is based on the abundant resources that we have and, in many ways, the ability of the state to address its challenges through the wealth that we have, in particular the wealth that we have with regard to our resources. So we think it's a cause for optimism. It's not fake optimism. And hopefully you'll see that kind of lace throughout the presentation. But we do know that we also have a lot of work to do. So with that, Mr. Chairman, with your permission, we'll start into the presentation.
And thank you, Commissioner. I'd just like to note that we have been joined by Representative Josephson. And if we do have an open seat here, if you'd like to sit up front.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You're welcome. All right, Commissioner.
Okay, so as I mentioned, Mr. Chairman, a lot to cover, and so we'll kick it off. The first thing I think it's always good, even for Alaskans, to get a sense of is just exactly what we do manage. And as you can see from the slide here, these are huge numbers. These are huge territories. We've had a lot of fun with this. One thing you'll see is we've gotten out quite a lot since the last legislative session, different parts of the country, different parts of the world even. And we always have fun kind of with this slide since we're bigger than most countries. And, you know, if there's any Texans in the audience, we always like to have them stand up and recite the first bullet under the land base.
Those look rather small down there underneath the land
base. Yeah, it's really small. But it does give a sense. And then, of course, on the ownership issues, that's a huge issue for the state with regard to federal, state, and native ownership. And very important working in partnership with those different entities to maximize our opportunity. And then, Mr. Chairman, I know you've seen these numbers before. The basic point here, and we can provide this committee with a lot more detail with some of our top professional staff here, either from the Division of Oil and Gas or our geological survey team. But as you know, these are huge numbers, and it's really a critical issue for everybody, not only in the legislature, but in the state, to realize this, because the potential of the state in many ways, in the oil and gas side in particular, we're just scratching the surface. I think that you look at a couple things from these slides. One, you see the conventional estimates on oil and gas, which are obviously enormous. But the thing, in particular in the last year, we've started to see is just how huge the potential is on the unconventional side with new technologies. So whether that's shale oil, shale gas, very positive, and we could brief this committee in more detail, but methane hydrate test production in the last year, which if we unlock that, you're talking hundreds of trillions of cubic feet of gas. And then this point on how relatively unexplored the basin is relative to other large basins throughout the United States, we give the one comparison. Wyoming, pretty big basin, is about the size of North Slope. We look at that number, about 19,000 exploration wells. Texas is about 250,000. North Slope is about 500. So still relatively unexplored, which we think also bodes for opportunity. Any numbers on Cook Inlet, which the USGS came out with a year and a half ago, those are also quite significant. And then this, again, these are estimates, but in the mineral sector, we did have our team about 2 years ago look at global estimates, USGS, and tried to assess where we would be if we were our own country, which any members of the legislature think would be a good idea. And if you, again, look at these numbers just in terms of critical minerals, some of the most important minerals in the world, rare earths also, we would rank in the top 10, again, estimates in these sectors. So it just gives a sense of just how enormous the potential and what the state has with regard to its mineral and oil and gas resource wealth. So the next thing I wanted to do, Mr. Chairman, and this is something as the commissioner I take a lot of pride in, is just introducing the team. And if they're here, I'm going to ask them just to quickly stand up and kind of giveaway, so you can again, put faces to names and any additional questions. But this is something that means a lot to us, having the whole team here, particularly for this committee. And it could take 5 hours to go through the accomplishments and challenges of each of these divisions. We list a few, but I'm proud to have this team with me. I think it's a great team. So we'll start with Francie Havermeister, who's the director of Division Ag. There's Francie. And again, I think one of the things that we've worked on really hard, and again, would welcome the opportunity for more ideas with this committee, a lot of things in the Department of Ag, but in the Alaska growing area, I think that we've tried to really highlight that to get essentially demand-driven more ag production from our own citizens. And we've taken a lot of strides in that in the last year. Next is Chris Mache, our director of forestry.
This is there.
And again, depending on where you live, you've seen the action of the department, a division of forestry, whether it's through management of state forests. The great work that Chris did as the leader of the governor's timber jobs task force, love to be able to present on that. But also in terms of the firefighting and that they do and provide, and I can tell you some truly heroic actions in the course of the last year. Bob Swenson is our director of the Division of Geological and Geographical Surveys. In addition to being an amazing musician, the leader of his own band, he's also a good geologist. We think one of the best, and we are very proud. The U.S., with the exception of the USGS, we think DGGS is probably the top geological survey team in the country. They've done tremendous work throughout the year, again, working closely with the legislature. Second year of implementing the statewide strategic and critical minerals assessment. And as you may have read in the paper, you know, that's a lot of high-tech work, but at the end of the day, you got to have boots on the ground to do that work. And those guys, I was out in the field with them this summer, and it's not always easy work, right? Locked and loaded, and getting stuck on mountaintops and things. Bob leads a great organization there.
Needs a new building.
We'd be happy to talk about that if you like. But we would agree with that, Mr. Chairman. Mining, land, and water, it's in many ways the heart and soul of DNR. Brent Goodrum is the director who is, I can tell you, as a retired Marine officer, he has really led the charge for this division. And they're making enormous progress, better than I had anticipated, on the permitting backlog, on making our permitting system more efficient, timely, and certain. You see some of the numbers there. And again, we would welcome the opportunity to have Brent testifying from this committee on exactly what they're doing and how they're focused on that. The Division of Oil and Gas, Bill Barron, is out with an important family event, but his deputy, Jeremy Slemons, is here. And this team, in many ways, is also critical to the state's operation. And always busy. Two more successful lease sales that they did great work on, and again, a whole slew of accomplishments in the past year that we could spend a long time on. Ben Ellis is our very creative, very energetic Parks and Outdoor Recreation Director. Ben, okay.
Oh, sorry. Chuck, he spends a lot of time outside, too.
He does, but he also spends a lot of time, I think he's done a great job of outreach to each individual legislator, telling about the different parks in their districts. As you know, Mr. Chairman, we have the largest park system, state park system in the United States by far. I do think, I said it in front of the Senate, maybe I should check with Ben, is Woodtick-Chick bigger than the state of Rhode Island?
Twice.
Twice, there we go. So we have one state park that's twice as big as the state of Rhode Island. And again, the creativity that and energy that Ben has brought to parks. Hopefully some of you had the opportunity to go to one of these Arts in the Park programs. They're fantastic. He's really energized that group. Gene Davis, our Director of Support Services. So Gene has done a fantastic job on essentially managing the finances of DNR, which is not an easy job, and I would say one of the hardest workers in the entire agency. The gas pipeline project office, that's Eric Hallberg, is the acting director.
On the last slide, under the key accomplishments, the e-recording, what exactly is that?
So that's, Gene, do you want to come up and give a little more detail on that?
Thank you. For the record, my name is Jean Davis. I'm the director of the Support Services Division, and the statewide recorder's offices is part of the Division of Support Services, and we have implemented or beginning to launch what we call e-recording, which will allow title companies and banks and lawyers, anybody who records documents with the department, to actually do it electronically.
So saving them a trip downtown?
We are saving them trips downtown. So we have implemented in the Anchorage Recording District and a couple of their outlying districts and Seward. Okay. And we are experimenting with that to see how it works.
Sounds great. Thanks.
So in addition to the different divisions, we have key offices also throughout DNR. The gas pipeline project office, they oversee the licensees' work with regard to the Alaska pipeline project, and again, in all kinds of progress. One of the things I wanted to highlight is how well they've worked with AGDC over the course of the past year. Really, really good cooperation there, and we think that that's an efficient use of the way in which different government agencies are working together. Similarly, we have the State Pipeline Coordinator's Office, Mike Thompson, who is leads another really great team. Mike has worked, I can tell you, the amount of hours they put into, you see that top bullet there on the issuance of the right-of-way for the Point Thompson Export Pipeline. A lot of work went into that, a lot of coordination with the federal government. Great team there, and they oversee a lot of important areas for the state. Tom Crawford is a director of the Office of Project Management and Permitting. That's OPMP. And Mr. Chairman, one of the things that you'll hear about, you've heard about from us over the last 2 years, is that we know we have challenges in the permitting area. We think we're making good progress. But I do want to highlight OPMP as a real highlight, right? We think this is an example not only for states but also for the federal government, where on large projects, the permittees come to the state, and OPMP coordinates all the permitting with state agencies. The state agencies are required to be part of that. They have an ombudsman kind of working that project. And importantly, because it's so effective, we do get federal government participation in those OPMP meetings on different projects, even though they're not required to be there. And we think that's another important aspect of OPMP, and it's a testament to Tom's leadership that they come to those meetings. So anyways, and that's a very quick overview. As I mentioned, important for us to have the team here for this overview hearing. And if there are any questions, Mr. Chairman or any other members, on just different responsibilities or different things that the different division directors have been working on, I'd be glad to entertain those. And just wanted to mention, just on the presentation, to make it less, I don't want to say boring, but, we'd be glad to entertain as we're going through the presentation. If there's any questions, certainly would be glad to take them as they come.
Any questions from members on with the commissioner? Representative Tarr?
You mentioned on one of these slides and the accomplishments, the second annual Alaska Strategic and Critical Minerals Summit. Is there any report from that summit, or is that available?
Through the chair, Representative Tarr, later in the, if you look down here on part four, mm-hmm, on the slides, we go into a lot of detail. I can give you updates on that now, or just to give you an update on that when we get to it. But no formal written report from it, but it's something we're very proud of, and we think holds enormous promise for the state, and we are making that an annual.
Mm-hmm.
in Fairbanks.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you. I'm sorry, I might have missed it. I might have glanced down and not noticed, but for Gasline Project Office, Eric Hadelberg.
Yes.
Is he here?
Eric is not here.
Oh, okay. I wanted to see what he looked like. Okay. Okay, that's all.
Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess this is probably for Eric also. But the alignment that we have with the North Slope producers and the Alaska Pipeline Project, does that mean, because we've heard that the AGDC may be the only project going forward, is that actually still moving? Is there still activity going on that? Is there still prospects and hope?
Through the chair, Representative Tuck, yeah, that's something I'll talk about rather extensively here on slide number two. But yeah, we think that a lot of work to be done, but we certainly think that there was in the past year significant progress.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions from members? Okay, please continue, Commissioner.
Okay, so Mr. Chairman, this is really the meat of what we wanted to testify about today. Again, it's an update since the last session, but also to give you, it's still kind of a wave top approach, but we wanted to highlight some of these key issues, and then obviously have the opportunity to dig in deeper with the committee during the course of the legislative session. So you see there, we have a number of areas that we want to cover, so we'll just move right into it. The first, and it's an issue that this committee is painfully aware of, but it is what we see as the most critical near-term economic issue facing the state, and that is the issue of the TAPS throughput and what we need to do to address it. I know the members here have seen these numbers before, but the critical issue is that the TAPS throughput continues to decline, despite the fact that we think, and again, we would welcome the opportunity to have our experts testify in front of this committee, despite the fact that we think that we clearly have the geology and oil and gas on the North Slope to sustain the state and TAPS for many, many, many years, if not decades to come, if we can unlock these different areas of potential. That last bullet, I think it's important for us to remind people, a lot of talk in this building last couple of years, even now, about a quote-unquote giveaway. In my view, the ultimate giveaway is when we continue to lose production each year. So, for example, last year we had about 40,000 barrels a day, 6% decline. Do the rough math, about 14.5 million barrels, not here this year, that we had last year. And that's funny that is not going anywhere. It's not circulating around the economy. It's not going to state coffers. It's gone. And that's a giveaway to future generations, and that's what we need to focus on stopping and turning around. So what we've focused on, and I know the committee has seen this many times, this has really in many ways been the focus of our efforts over the last 2 years, where we laid out a comprehensive plan to address the TAPS throughput issue. The governor has laid out last year a very, we know it's ambitious goal of 1 million barrels a day within 10 years to turn the TAPS throughput decline around. Again, if you look at other hydrocarbon basins, we know this is ambitious, but North Dakota went from 100,000 barrels to about 500,000 barrels in about 5 years. Texas has now turned around. North Sea places have turned around. Alberta's turned around. We can do this. And so what we've been focused on is this four-part strategy. The most important element there is making the state more competitive with regard to the capital that we're competing for. And a key part of that is what we believe is important is the governor's tax reform proposal is a cornerstone of that effort. But it's not the only efforts that we've been undertaking. To the contrary, we've been focused on all elements of this strategy for the past 2 years, and whether it's permitting, whether it's what we call facilitating, incentivizing the next phase of North Slope development, so whether that's smaller pools of conventional, more infield drilling, OCS opportunities in federal lands, unconventional opportunities. We've been focused on all of those, and I think what you're going to see here is we're starting to see interest in all of those, and we think that that's exciting. And then if you look at the last element, this is something that my team and others, the Department of Commerce certainly, we've been putting a lot of effort into getting out, talking about the resource base to potential investors, targeting certain investors that we think would make great companies to come to Alaska, going and pitching them. And we've really been promoting the resources here. So this has been a key element of the strategy. A lot of people say taxes are key, certainly, but we have been focused on this comprehensive plan for the last 2 years. We're starting to see some positive aspects of this, although, as I've mentioned in a theme here, will be we think we're just scratching the surface. But if you look at the last two lease sales that we've held in the state, both on the North Slope and in Cook Inlet, we've had very strong lease sales. So again, we've been going out pitching the state, pitching the lease sale terms with regard to both Cook Inlet and the North Slope. This is a busy slide, but it's just a snapshot of the activities that are going on in the past. We're going to have another busy exploration season. We're having it this winter. But really, this is the slide that we kind of wanted just to end with. What we're excited about here is diversity of plays. So again, huge OCS plays, smaller pool plays, conventional and unconventional oil plays, and diversity of players. Everything from some of the biggest oil companies in the world. ExxonMobil is now going to be an operator with the Point Thompson settlement. Shell, Conoco took out new exploration acreage near Point Thompson in the 2011 lease sale. Two smaller companies, Great Bear, Royale, Nordac, and then mid-sized companies that are critical to the state, Repsol, Armstrong. And so we think that this is important, but again, you see that last bullet, we still think we're just scratching the surface, and certainly with the issue of how much we need investment-wise on the North Slope, we need billions and billions more if we're going to turn around the TAPS throughput decline, which we think we can. So that gives you just a sense there. Another area that we're actually going to be testifying a lot more detail on in front of Senate resources this afternoon is with regard to Cook Inlet. We definitely have challenges there, but we've also seen really kicking in the past year what certainly we're viewing as a renaissance in terms of rigs, exploration, companies, spending, important developments such as storage. Representative Hawker, you know, is now on the committee. I think that a lot of what the legislature did in 2010 is really helping in this area. And again, we have been going out to companies all over the place pitching those tax incentives, those investment incentives, and trying to get that basin turned around. We're not there yet, but as you can see here, there's a lot of activity in Cook Inlet right now. 2 years ago, people thought this was pretty much a dead basin, and now you have some of the top companies that focus on mature basins, Apache, Hillcorp, that are spending quite a lot of money, and we're going to continue to focus on that. So, Mr. Chairman, I'm now going to, any other questions? That's kind of a focus on oil and gas, just Cook Inlet and the North Slope.
Commissioners, briefly, I remember reading something in the news about a potential gas line under the surface, undersea, maybe a trench from the west side of Cook Inlet to the Kenai River. Can you speak about that at all? Just let me know what it's about and where it stands.
Sure. Mr. Coach, I'm going to have Deputy Commissioner Balash take that.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Joe Balash, Deputy Commissioner at DNR. And I think, Representative Sadler, the pipeline you may have read about is actually an oil line, not a gas pipeline. Cook Inlet Energy has come in and applied for a right-of-way with our SPCO to move oil from the west side of Cook Inlet over to the east side where the refinery is located for Tesoro, as well as some additional opportunities for export and deliveries.
Is it a done deal? Is it an application, or is it a project that's actually going to go forth?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, it is an application at this point in time. We have a fairly robust process that we'll be going through in terms of public notice and opportunities for comment and review by multiple agencies.
Okay. And Mr. Bailash, Cook Gallen Energy is, as I recall, they run the Osprey platform, the very kind of the southwesternmost or the westernmost platform in Cook Inlet. How have they been getting oil out off their platform previously?
Mr. Chairman, my understanding of their operation is that they have a pipeline that runs from Osprey onshore on the west side there, and they, from that point, along with some of their other production that is onshore, move through the pipeline system down to the Drift River Terminal that multiple operators take advantage of and use then to load and move their oil, whether onto market or over onto the east side.
Okay. So this is not reconditioning or sleeving of an existing pipe. This is brand new pipe from one side of the inlet to the other?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
Okay, thanks. Any other questions? Representative Wilson.
Thank you. When you talked about the new players and the operators, and I just was looking real quick, and is Salvant on here?
Savant?
Savant, yeah.
Which
one is it?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson. Savant is the operator of the Badami field up on the north slope. They are the one furthest east from Prudhoe Bay before you get to Point Thompson.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Representative
Tuck. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know last year when we were in special session, we had a joint Energy Resources Committee hearing. We had, I think it's PRS Energy, I can't remember the name of them. We were talking about, you know, the possibility of determining what the decline curve is and then negotiating anything above that for incentivizing for more production going down the line. And I think we were looking at the chart, the decline, because I noticed you have in your presentation a 6% per year decline, which seemed really high according to what they were saying last year. And it looked like we were starting to get at a level off. And I think that was the big one of the discussions that we had is we're going to do 4.2, we're going to do 3.2. Why all of a sudden is it up to 6%? Is there any reason why the decline curve is it? I guess my real question is the decline curve reducing just from the nature of the fields automatically, or do we see more of a decline happening in the last 4 or 5 years?
Through the chair, Representative Tuck, the decline curve for the North Slope is actually an aggregation of multiple curves. You've got all of the different fields that are producing there. Some are declining more than others, and what you really see in that variation is a reflection of the level of investment that's going on. While the current tax regime has put some of a breaking effect on investment, there is still pretty significant dollar amount being invested in additional and ongoing activity on the slope. I think the real question comes down to what would that decline curve be without investment? And I can assure you it's much, much more than 6%. With regard to the specifics of total North Slope production, we've got some figures that we can pull together for you and also break it out by the individual fields.
If I may, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
Thank you. Yeah, so, but I think the numbers that we got in your 2011 report, I believe were the averages. And it looked like it was forecasted to flatten out to 3.2% per year on average through 2030. So I don't know, it just seems like the 6% is kind of a big jump compared to what was reported before. And it says here over the last 10 years, production decline rate was 4.2% per year on average. So is that based on our current tax structure now that you're looking at 6% per year? Is that what we're, I'm just trying to figure out where the 6% came from, how it ended up jumping up so high from the forecast from before.
The bases for the production forecast are numbers that are generated by the Department of Revenue. They are able to work with each of the individual taxpayers on a confidential basis to understand what their expectations are for the next decade. And the numbers in the production forecast are a reflection of those estimates by the producing companies with a certain degree of discounting, risk factoring for what you would otherwise call new production. We're pretty good at identifying the level of decline that will occur in the existing fields from currently producing areas. Where the state's projections have been historically off by a lot is in estimating new production more than 4 to 6 years out. And that's where you've seen an undertaking by the Department of Revenue jointly with the Department of Natural Resources to get a much more clear-eyed and realistic view of what production is going to be for the next decade. Our error rate historically has been big. And if we were to just return to the fiscal year 2007 forecast for the current fiscal year, we should be producing something like 685,000 barrels a day. And I think 130. Mm-hmm. So there were some problems in the old way that was being projected. We think we're taking prudent steps to correct that so that you as policymakers have reasonable information to make what we know will be reasonable decisions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
In fact, as I recall, Mr. Balash, that discrepancy in what was predicted versus what was the result years later was a major concern of this committee during the debate on the last bill. Now, I understand Revenue has revamped their system. Did they take that new way of figuring things out and test that against, you know, data previously? I mean, did they take and look back to see, I mean, do we have any assurance that their new method of forecasting is going to be more accurate than the previous method of forecasting?
Mr. Chairman, I think the my understanding of the process that was undertaken was done in, I think I'm using this term correctly, in a double-blind manner. We had in one corner a statistical estimate and analysis that was used to say, gee, if here's what history has shown us to be realizing, and we take that analysis and curve forward, what will happen? And then we did a technical estimate with the reservoir engineers and use that as a basis for making the projections and sort of risking out the likelihood of that new production coming in. And when we brought those two methods together, there was a considerable overlap in what they were going to forecast for the next decade. And that gave us greater confidence that there wasn't a blind spot in either approach that was going to cause us to be off. The feedback that we've gotten so far in reviews of this new methodology have been quite positive, although there's still a few negative Nancys out there who think we're still being too optimistic.
Representative, thank you, Mr. Chair. So looking at the past history of, let's say, Prudhoe Bay Field, for example, is the decline curve starting to flatten out, looking at the numbers that you do know, or is it starting to get steeper?
Through
Through the chair, Representative Tuck, the slope of the curve is one that, you know, depending on how you want to measure, can vary wildly from month to month, quarter to quarter, year to year. We have seasonal variances in the productive efficiency of the facilities. So you see a big swing from summer to winter. If you want to compare year to year, I would say annual barrels produced against annual barrels produced is probably a better way to think about the problem, so that you're not getting caught up in differences between either seasons or maintenance periods or what have you. What we're seeing is that the degree to which that decline is either accelerating or decelerating does not seem to have a hard and fast rule. It really is a function of the activity going on in the field, and if we want to slow it down even further, we need to get more rigs turning to the right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, Commissioner. Representative Seed. One last question.
Thank you. And I was wondering if you could fill us in at all on shale development, that's exploration and development that's taking place.
I'll head on a little of that and then.
Through the chair, just to wrap up that last conversation, we would be glad to have our teams come in, Representative Tuck, and give you kind of the way they've been looking at it. Bill Barron, our director of oil and Division of Oil and Gas, was very instrumental in the estimates with regard to the Department of Revenue this year. We think it's a lot more of a responsible way in which to look at this, particularly given how off we've been in the past. And I think, as Joe was kind of insinuating, ultimately we're at a certain point during some hearings last year, there seemed to be an interest in how low can you go soda analysis. We're ultimately really interested in debating someday, hopefully not in the too far distant future, what the slope of the rise or increasing curve is, and but we'd be glad to give an update on exactly the methodology that went into the new forecast this year, because it's important and it was changed. So through the chair, Representative Seaton, one of the things that we've been doing, and I think you've been a important leader in this, we appreciate it, is trying to get in front of the shale development in the state. So not being caught flat-footed, but looking at that as a big opportunity, and trying to make sure that from a policy or regulatory perspective, we are doing things to help encourage that. You see there was a July 31st conference on shale oil. Importantly, Great Bear is the main player right now. They have a huge acreage in that area. But one of the things that, again, it goes to this marketing piece. We actually did a trip. It was not this past year, but a little over a year ago, on Wall Street, to private equity groups, investment banks, again to pitch them on the opportunities in Alaska. One of the main targets that we had during that trip is now a big investor in Great Bear. So we think that kind of advocacy helps. They drilled two wells. Do you want to give just a quick update on the specifics?
Great Bear, through the chair, Representative Seaton, Great Bear was able to take advantage of the seasonal exploration season on the rest of the North Slope and get hold of a rig that they could use in the summer months. And because their play is located close to existing infrastructure, they were able to drill without use of an ice pad or ice roads. And they drilled two wells. At both wells, they were able to take core samples, which they have undertaken lab analysis on, but they did not achieve a flow test at either location. And a flow test is going to be critically important to understanding the productive capacity of the rocks themselves. What's the initial production going to be, and what is the decline rate going to be in the first 6 to 12 months? That's going to tell us an awful lot about whether a shale play on the North Slope can work. The costs in Alaska are much higher than they are in other places. From the work that we've done sort of on a tabletop review, we think our rocks are incrementally better than some of those other places, but until there's actual testing done, we won't know.
Follow up. Thank you. For a flow test in a shale development, I presume that we need to have hydraulic fracturing so that we have a producing well and not, I mean, that's in the whole history of all of the increase in production in North Dakota and in Texas is based on the same kind of technology and the same kind of unconventional development. So I guess I was wondering about timing on the when we're looking at a potential for a flow test. And then beyond that, presuming that we get good production, it seems that what we've been talking about for a couple of years is that the holdup in a shale development is going to be year-round availability to roads, to pads, to gravel structures. And I'm wondering what is transpiring now to make those plans or coming to the legislature for changing policies for roads, for access, year-round access to those developments if they turn out to be positive.
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, the specific plans that Great Bear and its partners are undertaking have been done with a mind to try and shorten the amount of time it will take to get to the answer, can this work? Can it work profitably? We look forward to reviewing their updated plan of operations when it comes into the division, but we don't have anything that is more recent than what we've described in terms of core samples. And they did ask to do some flow tests that they did not get done before they released the rig in November. So we expect, based on what we've been told, that they will endeavor to do those horizontal wells with frack jobs and flow tests in the year ahead, but the specific timing we don't know yet.
And the second part of that question was on roads and access and how we would envision that development taking place in Alaska if it becomes viable.
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, I hope to be talking to members of your sister committee about funding in the FY14 budget that would go to some additional work we need to do at the Division of Oil and Gas or through the Division of Oil and Gas along with Mining, Land, and Water on some area-wide planning that would help make the decisions around intensive levels of activity possible, and so that we don't have a big traffic jam in the permitting pipe, so to speak.
May I, if Mr. Chairman, just through the chair, just to follow up on a couple things, Representative Seaton, you're putting your finger on some really important issues, and we appreciate that because from the permitting perspective, from the year-round access perspective, to make Alaska competitive in this area, we think that those are going to be important. And so we appreciate your interest.
we, in some ways, you know, it's hard to get too far out in front. I mean, but from the geological perspective, we're pretty bullish here. As you know, we have these three different pay zones. We, you know, it's the source rock of Prudhoe Bay, which most people think, you know, obviously has enormous potential. The issue we keep hearing about, though, is can we compete with regard to costs? And it is important to recognize that, you know, we have Great Bear there. We're, you know, we certainly are hopeful that some of the work that they're doing on is proves fruitful for the state, but it's not just them. And what we have been doing is we have been getting out and making people aware of this potential, you know, not just one company, but very broadly. And one of the things that we've been pitching, we had an opportunity to have a big lunch down in Houston where probably 80 or 90 people came who were interested in Alaska, and we made the case that we're probably the only place in the country where you can be in a certain area looking for the opportunities on shale oil and also bumping into significant pools of conventional. And we think that that's a pretty strong pitch, and so we want more than just Great Bear up there. We would love some of the incumbents to start looking in this area. And so we're encouraging this play well beyond Great Bear, although, you know, they're the first mover in Alaska, and, you know, success of a first mover can often encourage many, many other investors. So we know a lot of folks are watching them, and we appreciate your attention and assistance on it.
Just a quick one.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. AOGCC has some regulations out right now related to hydraulic fracturing. Is that related to this development, and in what way?
Through the chair, Representative Tarr. The AOGCC did publish notice in December on regs related to fracking and the disclosure requirements around that. Mm-hmm. That is something that, to our understanding, it is intended to get in front of some of the issues that have confronted other states in the nation. But fracking has been going on the North Slope for more than 40 years. Mm-hmm. That said, they are engaged in a public process at the commission. Mm-hmm. The comment deadline was extended, as I understand it, and there will be an opportunity for a rulemaking by that agency, which, you know, is separate from the Department of Natural Resources. So the three commissioners there are acting independently. Mm-hmm. I do want to come back to the question that Representative Seaton asked and just highlight for this committee a bill which I believe was referred here on Friday related to primacy on wetlands. Mm-hmm. With all of the activity on the North Slope that may be triggered by this kind of a resource play, or frankly just any other development of new fields, is going to require these wetlands permits from the Army Corps of Engineers. And that, quite frankly, could become, and we see as one of the real potential threats to the success of a play like this. With all of the questions surrounding sequestration and the continued support of federal agencies, regulatory agencies, we see it as a real need to obtain the ability from the Corps of Engineers to issue our own 404 permits in compliance with the federal program. And hope to be working with all of you on that in fairly short order.
Yeah, it'd be a good way to help save the federal government some money, wouldn't it? Imagine that. All right. Had a great discussion. Lots of good questions. Please continue, Mr. Commissioner.
I've got one quick question on page 19. Looks like we're on page 21 all of a sudden. But the second bullet point, new players. We had the Cook Inlet Stampede recently, and we had one of the first companies to respond was a company named Buccaneer that shortly thereafter changed their name to Fury, and I don't notice them on the list. Is there anything going on with Buccaneer / Fury that hasn't made the news? But
I mean, Escobeta Fury.
Escobeta / Fury. that's going on right now? Are they current on their drilling timelines, or how come they're not on the list, I guess?
Are you referring, Mr. Chairman, through the chair, Representative Wilson? Escapeda was the former name of the company. Fury is certainly current in its unit obligations. They and I think their absence from this list is not intended to be indicative of anything, just an oversight on our part. I think if you were to look at slide 20, I hope that we've got them highlighted here in the activity map. They are very much on our radar screen. We did successfully complete the negotiation on extending the unit agreement with obligations in different sections of the unit itself, ongoing drilling obligations that they've taken on.
Thank you.
Please proceed.
And Mr. Chairman, just a point on that, and we're going to make it a little bit more in the Senate Resources Committee, but I do want to compliment Bill Barron, who's not here, and his team, but you see in these slides a lot of drilling activity. And one of the things that we've tried to do, and Bill's done a really good job, is leveraging our ability to, whether it's through leases, lease terms, or through unit applications, to say, okay, roger that, let's talk, right? And let's... we might extend a unit, we might have a lease in this area, but we need activity. We need wells being drilled. And we've been doing that throughout both Cook Inlet and the North Slope, and I think you're seeing that that's been a, it's having some positive results. So, Mr. Chairman, switch gears here a little bit. Representative Tuck, this goes directly to your question, next several slides. But just an overview from the past year in terms of commercializing North Slope gas, and I'll talk both about what's going on with the APP project and the AGDC project. But what I wanted to mention here, if you look at slide 21, we think, you know, if you looked at where we were a year ago with regard to the producers, Exxon, Conoco, BP, they weren't aligned at all on a gas project. Heck, they weren't even talking. You had Exxon and TransCanada that had yet to look to where we thought the real market was, and that's in Asia. You had Conoco and BP had recently folded Denali, and what we thought was positive in the past year, if you looked a year ago, the governor laid out in his State of the State benchmarks for progress on a gas line in the state's interest. And you look at, I won't go through each one of those, but you look at the five, really the four benchmarks there. And I remember when he gave that speech a year ago, you know, there's a number of folks who came up and said, hey, that was really great, but good luck with that, right? Some of those benchmarks have never been met ever. You're gonna knock those out in the next couple months. And what was positive is that we did. The state and the different companies working. We know we have a long way to go, as the governor stated in the State of the State just this past week, but it's hard to deny some of the progress. So what I'd like to do is quickly review some of that. The first important thing here was the governor talked about alignment. If you look at what makes different projects come together, it's not impossible, certainly, to have a gas line without alignment, but having the alignment of these companies working together with their expertise on a project, we also think is important. And what happened at the end of the first quarter last year, after a meeting with the CEOs from Exxon, Conoco, and BP in Alaska, they did come back to the governor at the end of the first quarter and say, we're aligned, we're going to be focused particularly on an LNG project. Similarly, and that's the letter there, and that's unusual, right? These companies compete all over the world. You know, we joke about it was probably even difficult to figure out how they negotiated, who got to sign it first. Importantly, as part of that, and they mentioned it in the letter and as part of the governor's benchmarks, we also resolved the Point Thompson dispute. There's a map of Point Thompson. We think it's important to point that out. You look at, it's the green area, by the way, right by Point Thompson. That's Anwar. Everywhere else, that's state land.
But what's really important to look at in terms of this map is just where the infrastructure on the North Slope ends, and it ends in the eastern North Slope at Badami. Despite the fact that we know that the eastern part of the North Slope where Point Thompson is and all areas around there are very, very prolific areas for hydrocarbons. So we think this is a, and the governor mentioned it in his latest State of the State just a couple days ago, but we think this is a strategic development and investment for the state for a number of reasons. The first, as I mentioned, it opens up the eastern North Slope to hydrocarbon production. So now, as part of the settlement, Exxon's building a 70,000-barrel-a-day common carrier pipeline with regard to liquids into taps. What that means now is if you're a small company and you're out exploring in that part of the North Slope of Alaska and you find liquids, you can now plug into that pipeline, where before, and this is one of the inhibitors, we think, for that part of the state, previously, had you been out there and you did find hydrocarbons, you needed to be a very big company to develop the infrastructure to get it into taps. Well, now we think that's going to have the opportunity strategically to open up that part of the North Slope for particularly oil development. But also, it's a multi-billion dollar project at Point Thompson. That gives you a little sense of what's being built there. This next slide. But we think that, importantly, significant elements of this infrastructure, can be used for gas commercialization. So having that pre-investment to gas, while their companies are spending multiple billions on this project, we think it's really important to help get the gas project going as well. And then, of course, the other reason we think this is such a strategic investment is jobs. Jobs, jobs, jobs. The estimates are in the initial phase here that this will create about 600 to 700, maybe even close to 800, possibly peaking beyond 2,000 jobs. And we can come and brief this committee in more detail on the different subcontractors who are now working, but we're seeing a lot of activity. So what happened, again, since the last legislative session with regard to the settlement, was it went through essentially three additional phases. After it was settled, we went through kind of a phase of explaining and defending the settlement. So the AG, Deputy Commissioner Balash, a couple hearings in the Senate in particular that we explained. We went all over the state explaining the settlement, because it's a big deal to the state and people had to understand it. We're defending it, right? Somebody continues to sue on this. Why anybody would want to sue on a project that is employing hundreds of Alaskans and developing our resources beyond me, but we're being successful in that endeavor so far. And then the permitting aspect of this with the feds, with the North Slope Borough, took essentially throughout the spring, throughout the summer, throughout the fall, a lot of work. We got all those permits out in time. And then the third phase of what we've been doing is essentially getting to work, having the ice roads approved and having construction, which is beginning this winter season. So we saw that as important. And those two benchmarks being met, which was important to us, we think it's important to highlight to this committee the national press that we are seeing with regard to this progress. So here you see at the end of March, a Financial Times article, big article from the Financial Times of London, talking about the progress that was made in the first quarter. And then the third quarter benchmarks that the governor laid out in his State of the State were also met. And here's a letter that came from the different producers in TransCanada. Again, with the announcement and some of the details on what they had been doing, how they're working together, you saw front page Wall Street Journal articles, front page Globe and Mail in Toronto. That one in particular I like, if you take a look at it, because I'm going to talk a little bit about the competition globally. And that article kind of highlights that Western Canada, which we certainly see as one of the biggest areas that we have to compete with regard to large-scale LNG project, they're noticing and maybe getting a little bit nervous, and that's good. We think that that's an area that we have to recognize how much we have to compete. So very quickly, what I wanted to do is just show what the company's laid out in that letter. They talked about the integrated team they're working on. They have about 200 people working. They're spending tens of millions right now. And I get asked frequently, well, look, what is this? Is this real? Is it not real? I mean, my first reaction is go ask the companies, right? There's a lot of skepticism in the state, and I think given the 40-year history of trying to commercialize North Slope gas, some of that skepticism is warranted. And but we've had the briefings. There's little doubt, and hopefully you're going to get more briefings here, that the work that these companies are doing, Exxon in the lead, BP working the upstream issues, bringing all their previous work together, TransCanada and Exxon in the midstream and Conoco doing the downstream work, we think is important. They laid out what the governor asked for, hardening the numbers on the project. As you may have seen in the State of the State, he wants a lot more detail than just this. These are ranges. He wants actual detail. He's asked for that within a month. But even when you look at this detail, one of the takeaways here is that this would be one of the largest LNG projects in the world. Combined with our massive North Slope resources, we think that that's pretty important. And then also as part of that letter, you saw a timeline, a work plan that the companies put out. And again, we think that this is important. It's a very busy chart here. And the key message that I would say to this committee, what we've been saying to these companies is, yes, that looks good, but we need you to work to accelerate that timeline. And that's what the governor did in his latest State of the State when he said, we've made progress, but we want this timeline accelerated. Now, we have work to do as well, but so do the companies, and the alignment's critical, but it also can't mean alignment, and then if you have a least common denominator company that doesn't want to get to work, we need to keep this moving, and we would respectfully request that as you're meeting with the companies, pull out this timeline and ask them to accelerate. That's exactly what we've been focusing on. So, and then I also want to mention the governor laid out as another benchmark, and he laid it out even more detail in his latest State of the State, is the work in the kind of consolidation efforts that he is envisioning with regard to the work that has been going on with AGDC. And we think the important news here is that the governor talked about parallel paths. If you look over the course of the last year, the APP has made progress on alignment with regard to upstream producers. When they're working together, these are the leaseholders, this is where the gas supply is, and also the technical work, the engineering work that is going on with regard to the work that these companies are doing. The work at AGDC, which has also been important and has made progress in the last year, has principally been in the area of the regulatory, right-of-way, EIS progress, and you see that you need all of that to come together. So that's good parallel work, and that's why the governor's talking about looking at ways in which to integrate those efforts. So he mentioned that again as part of the State of the State. So we do think that there's been progress. If you look at his benchmarks from 2012, that they've been met, but as you can see from the governor's latest State of the State, you know, we're not satisfied. We need to continue to press. We need to continue and accelerate the momentum, and that's what he laid out with regard to the State of the State. But you do have, even comments recently, the top official in Conoco talked about at the Alliance Meet Alaska, the possibility of things come together of a sanction date sometime in 2015. The sanction is the square on this chart that we should really focus on, because that means it looks like that would be the decision to move forward. And we think that as they move through these different stage gates, there's more spending, more people working on it, and we think that is what we need to continue to do to accelerate that. So, Mr. Chairman, I wanted to move next to you hopefully get a sense of optimism from what we're talking about. But one of the reasons we have that is something else that wasn't mentioned in the State of the State. But one of the things that we tried to do in the past year was really get out, not wait for the producers, but to get out into different markets, to different potential buyers, and talk about the comparative advantages of of the Alaska gas to other countries. There's clearly demand for gas in Asia. How long that window is going to be open is anyone's guess. And what we thought was important was to get out over the course of the last year and talk about the comparative advantage of the Alaska project, talk about the progress that the APP and the AGDC projects have made, and really emphasize that, look, the state is very focused on this. We've got two efforts. And so what I want to do here is very quickly just give you a sense, without going into too much detail, these are the kind of things that we talked about when we talk about comparative advantages. And we've literally given this presentation to, if you're talking conferences, meetings, embassy briefings in Tokyo, private meetings with government officials throughout Asia, hundreds, if not thousands of people have seen these comparative advantages. What are they? Huge resource base, essentially zero resource risk, co-located with existing infrastructure, so limited environmental impact. This one, and this is large measure due to Conoco's great work in the inlet, but our strong record of reliability. A lot of people, but the Japanese know this, don't know that the only place in North America that is exporting LNG has been for 40 plus years is Alaska. We highlighted this significantly. And as you can see, whenever we did this, we also did not refrain from essentially pointing out the limitations of our competition. So you see, we're talking about reliability in this slide. The last bullet talks about using gas for political purposes. That's a reference to our friends in Russia, who we don't consider reliable suppliers of gas. Comparative advantages due to geographic proximity, political legal stability, again, compared to other competition that we will have. Cost estimates, these are recent studies in the past 2 years that have come out. State didn't have anything to do with them, but they priced Alaska gas competitively with almost any other project in the world. We highlighted that. World-class businesses, great support services already working in Alaska. Comparative advantages related to export licenses, regulatory progress. Again, we pointed out, for example, Western Canada projects have not resolved their First Nations and Native land claim settlements. Those are huge issues in Canada. They could take a long time to resolve. We point out that we have resolved these issues. And then even things that, such as pointing out that we've previously received export permission from the federal government. This is somewhat controversial now with regard to export licenses from the lower 48, but we feel that we're well positioned on additional permitting, additional export licenses relative to other projects. This is an example. President Reagan, right before he left office under the National Gas Act, found that large quantities of Alaska gas would not export it, would not have a negative impact on prices in the U.S. And then, of course, we always highlight the opportunities for upstream investment. Finally, in these meetings, we did start to point out where we thought Alaska had advantages over other potential competitors. And you look at some of these other potential LNG export competitors, and we highlight some of the things that we think we have over these other competition. So just wrapping up that section on gas, I think that, you know, certainly from the perspective here, we think we're back on the map. And I'll give you one anecdote on that. We were invited in September to present at the LNG Producer Consumer Conference, which was put on by the government of Japan. And it essentially had all the ministers from all the main producing countries, Canada, Russia, Australia, Qatar, all the main companies, buyers, sellers, and government agencies. And at the outset, the senior Japanese officials who introduced the entire conference highlighted the Qatari delegation. Qatar is the number one supplier of LNG in the world. When Japan went through the Fukushima disaster, they needed gas quickly because they were shutting down their nuclear facilities. The senior Japanese officials introducing everybody at this huge conference highlighted the Qataris, thanked them for coming, thanked them for their assistance. And then the only other delegation that they highlighted at the outset of this conference was the delegation from Alaska. And they said Alaska has been our longest standing supplier. They were the pioneer in exporting LNG to Asia. And we are very glad that they're here and looking forward to a new kind of new levels of cooperation and commercial arrangements between Alaska and Japan. And of course, as you can imagine, we were pretty happy about that. It certainly demonstrated from our perspective that we are back on the map, and but we have to realize that we're competing in an area that's going to be pretty steep competition. So that's a pretty quick overview of a year in progress on some of the gas issues. I'd be glad to take questions if there are any.
Representative Tuck, then Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, that's music to my ears. The export licensing.
Yeah.
What's the process, or what does it take to get a long-term export license for natural gas?
Yeah. So the export license itself would come from the Department of Energy. So, for example, right now Representative Tuck, the Conoco plant in Cook Inlet has a DOE export license. One of the things that's come up a lot, and again, we use this in our advocacy to our advantage, is that, as you know, there's I would just call it straight up a controversy in the lower 48 about how and how much and to what degree to allow exports of gas from the lower 48 shale plays. And this is a big issue because in certain parts of the country, the huge increase in production in places like Ohio and Pennsylvania has really ignited a manufacturing renaissance in those parts of the country where steel factories are coming online. Chemical factories are now coming back to the U.S. because of large amounts of gas at low costs. And there's a debate on whether how much to export. With some expectations that some of that will be limited because there's a concern if you export too much, the prices will go up and the volumes will go down. What we've been doing, again, over the course of the past year is meeting with the federal agencies, whether it's senior officials at the Department of Energy, at the White House, at the National Security Council staff, at the Department of Interior, and explaining to them that, look, as you guys struggle with this export license issue from Law 48, don't include us, right? We actually present to you almost the flip side of the issue, which is if we have a large-scale LNG project, volumes to Alaskans will increase, certainly, and prices to Alaskans and our military and maybe to Hawaiians will decrease. So we actually represent the flip side of the problem that you're worried about. And we think that meeting with members of Congress, we've also raised this with some of the key members of Congress on this issue, we think that we have a leg up on this issue. We think that the regulatory risk in terms of getting an export license is much less than it would be for lower 48, in part because of we've done it previously, as you see here. That's not an export license, but that was we still think, by the way, this is in force, right? Our lawyers think this is a legitimate presidential finding. We've given it to DOE. We've given it to the White House. They're taking a look at it. But we also noted, look at this map, look at how many in the Gulf are trying to export. And again, we think from a regulatory risk perspective on an export license issue, we have a leg up with regard to other competition, particularly the Gulf states. The Gulf export LNG projects, and we have been highlighting that to potential customers.
And follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The my understanding is, because I can't remember if I got this from a tour of an LNG plant from years ago, but one of the problems that we've had in being able to sell gas to Japan has been the short periods of leases you know, being such a short period, we weren't able to do long-term. And so so we used to do a big portion of their power generation over there and just been diminishing over the years because we're limited to, like, 5 years lease agreements. Is that part of the problem that we're having trying to secure those markets, is just trying to go long-term? I know one of the hurdles is just trying to get a lease, an export lease. The second hurdle is making it long-term.
Through the chair, Representative Tuck, this is Joe Balash. The nature of the LNG trade and business is one that is fundamentally different than what we're accustomed to in the North American marketplace. The LNG business is all about contracts. Do you have them? Can you get them? And they're different contracts than the ones associated with an overland pipeline. In the North America context, we were most concerned about getting shipping contracts, FT agreements, between a shipper and a pipeline. In an LNG case, you need to make sure there are arrangements in place all the way from the well bore to the burner tip in your market destination. And you've hit on something that is important, and that is the ability to offer long-term contracts and, importantly, firm contracts. Firm contracts that aren't interrupted. And, you know, I think if you just look back a little ways here to our own example here in Cook Inlet. In the winter of 2010-2011, ConocoPhillips had announced that they were in fact going to shutter the Nikiski plant. That was in large part because of the market dynamic they were faced with. Short-term spot type cargoes were selling at a price significantly lower than those under long-term contracts. The Asian premium that is available to a long-term contract. In the wake of Fukushima, however, the spot price in Japan in particular and other Asian markets shot up and actually made the business of moving gas on spot pricing more attractive than it had been. In fact, attractive enough that it made sense to keep the plant operating. In the long run, those prices are not likely going to remain higher than long-term contracts. And so we need to position ourselves, and fortunately with, you know, in excess of 30 TCF of reserves in the ground on the North Slope, we have a volume of gas, a resource that can be used to assure buyers of a very long and firm commitment of supply that we think is a tremendous advantage over numerous of our competitors at this point.
And we can guarantee that supply without shortchanging our own citizens.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
Okay. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As you've been going around marketing the idea of Alaska gas as LNG as a exported raw material, with the imposition of the emissions control area, or the potential, even if that's delayed, for being a longer term, the market of actually producing low sulfur diesel from Alaska gas for sale and supplying all the shipping that goes out of Alaska that is going to require that low sulfur content. Have you been marketing or have you been exploring that idea as well for the utilization of Alaska's gas instead of just exporting a raw material?
So through the chair, Representative Seaton, just a couple points on that. You know, what, if you look, and I won't go back, but if you look at the principles that the governor laid out, how we've been talking about it, you know, the whole idea here is large volumes for export, but also significant volumes to Alaskans. I mean, that's critical. And as you saw in the governor's State of the State, he actually refined that more to Alaskans first and then export. So, for example, if you looked at the, skipping back here, some of the numbers here that they looked at, kind of the, at least in the initial design concept and work plan here, the state offtake, about 300 to 350 million cubic feet per day on this project. I think what's the current state demand, like 250? So I think current state demand is about 250. So that's about, you know, good 100 million cubic feet per day more. And of course, from our perspective, we think having our gas to Alaskans is not only important for their use, but as you're talking about, looking at other opportunities for industry and other value added. And so, but to specifically answer your question, I did not specifically go into that kind of detail in terms of potential other uses or value added within the state, but it's, I think it's a good point. Mr. Chairman, just one other kind of wrap-up point on the gas commercialization that I failed to mention. One of the positive things we've seen from a lot of this outreach, the governor was in Korea and Japan, is that interested parties are now showing up in Alaska. So, for example, he referenced this in the State of the State, but we had the chairman and CEO of Korea Gas and his LNG purchasing team were here in Juneau about a month ago for 2 days, and very fruitful discussions with them. There's a Japanese consortium, REI, that has opened offices in Anchorage. Mitsui came to Anchorage to meet with us for further discussions. So there's been a lot of additional interest, and it's been demonstrated by the fact that these groups, these companies, are now starting to come to Alaska. And we're, of course, as you can imagine, encouraging this. What we've been trying to do over really the last year is set up different pieces on the big chessboard of trying to align stakeholder interests. If you look at where, and I'm certainly no expert, but I've tried to get up on the history of our efforts over 40 years to try to commercialize North Slope gas. And where we've had problems is where the different stakeholder alignment doesn't come together. And that's, of course, Alaskans is the number one stakeholder, the most important, but producers, consumers, the market itself, and trying to work that alignment has been what we've been trying to do and get those different pieces. And I think the governor's State of the State indicated this, but also have the ability to make sure, hey, if this doesn't happen or people are dragging their feet, we have the ability to move forward either with, you know, partners or without. And that's why he highlighted the important work at AGDC as well. So we think that we've made some pretty good strides, but we got a long way to go. And if those benchmarks in the governor's State of State are met in the next few months, we'll see that there's going to be additional progress or maybe not. We certainly hope there will be.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. TransCanada, are they part of the negotiations in the contracts with our delegation going over to Japan and then Japan being over here now and having these discussions? I mean, I remember 2009-10, we had a lot of reports that were coming back from TransCanada,
yeah,
keeping us updated. It just seems like the last 2 or 3 years they've kind of been either diminished or it gives the appearance of being uninterested. Are we going to hear from them?
Chair, Representative Tuck, so TransCanada held a solicitation of interest. They laid out that they had a strong solicitation of interest that was required by the state for them to do that. But in terms of the specific marketing in Asia, that's typically done by the producers on a private sector project. And you know, essentially what we've told the producers is, look, we know that Asia needs gas. We know Alaskans need gas. And it's also very likely that as you're going to Asia, you have a global portfolio of gas that you're probably offering up, whether it's Qatar, Australia, Alaska, Canada, Lower 48. And essentially what we're trying to do is get there before you do. So when you start marketing this, we have buyers and government say, hey, I have enough Qatari gas. I have enough of your Russia gas. I don't want any more Australia gas. I need to diversify my sources of supply. and I'm really interested in your Alaska gas. So we've told the producers that's exactly what we're doing. And we think that that's a useful use of our time to help drive and accelerate our project.
Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Since we're not going to be using a traditional model, if we're going to be doing these long-term leases, you know, in what way are you developing the model for what length of time we should be looking at doing these leases to get the best, you know, value for the state?
So
licenses.
Through the chair, Representative Gar, the distinction, there's a couple of words that have been thrown around, and I want to be clear about which relate to the parts in question. The contracts, the purchase and sale agreements between buyers and sellers of LNG vary. Alaska offers the opportunity for very long-term contracts. But contracts are, in some ways, we're seeing now a little bit of a precursor to authorizations for export licenses that are issued by the Department of Energy. Recently, we've seen the DOE take a longer, harder look at whether or not an applicant, in fact, has either gas or contracts or both before granting an export license. So you can't sell LNG to very many places unless you have an export license, and so we're starting to see a little bit of a it's not quite a catch-22, but there's definitely some steps being taken from a regulatory sense that we need to be mindful of and careful to watch to make sure that we don't get hung up in a bureaucratic process as this project moves forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. One more, Representative Tucker.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. The concept that the governor would like to see happening by, I believe, February 15th, what would the governor like to see in that concept? If you don't mind, just briefly just mention it. What do we hope to see?
So, through the chair, Representative Tuck. So here you saw the governor that the companies go through a process, and they're going through it now, called concept selection, where they do the engineering, they look at all the details of putting together a project. And then if you look at this stage-gated process here, they move into kind of the pre-feed, what the front-end engineering and design is. As you keep moving forward, you'll see the spend level on the private sector side increases dramatically. We like that. The more they're spending, the more likelihood that that's going to take hold. And so, but we've been a little bit, to be perfectly honest, a little bit frustrated that the concept selection work has not been finalized. So if you see here, they have ranges on this project concept description. And again, the work's been substantial. Even bring in what we think, as you know, these companies have very different cultures, very different histories. Bringing them all together, having a team, as I mentioned, is about 200 right now, working this is important. But the governor wants to see this with regard to, I don't need ranges, I need numbers on a specific project. So he actually laid out, in the state of the state, some pretty specific details on capacity of the plant, what size pipe, what size volumes are we looking at, location of the gas treatment plant. That's a huge issue that for some reason evidently is still being discussed. But so we think that, and he thinks that having that level of detail is what we need, and then to move into this next phase, have the commercial agreement to do that, and make sure we don't lose a summer season. And so you know, that's all coming up pretty rapidly, and but I think it's our view that laying out the benchmarks last year I can tell you, being one of the guys on the side trying to meet those as well, those were for state officials too. Point Thompson was an agreement between the state and the companies. Having a March 30th deadline by your boss that's pretty serious helps. It's what we refer to as an action-forcing event, and we're hopeful that we're going to see that here come the 15th of February as well.
And Commissioner, as part of the making public the concept, does that include the actual location of the terminal? I'm just trying to figure out when to order the champagne for Valdez.
So, Mr. Chairman, I think recognizing that that's an issue that it was not included in there.
Good.
So that particular one, given some of the sensitivities with regard to where, was not included, and we're hoping to see that soon, but that wasn't part of what the governor had mentioned as specifics in the state of the state.
Tell them to hold off on their order for a little bit longer. Representative Wilson.
Thank you. Commissioner, and I'm sure that this has all been figured out and refigured and all kinds of things, but do you know yet, or is that still being worked on, whether the LNG plant is on the North Slope and people get transported to work there, or whether it's on down here and then you have to count the cost of moving it down? And is that what they're working on right now?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, yes. It's the gas treatment facility.
Okay.
That's the key issue. And they've been looking at both options hard. Okay. But that was part of what the governor had requested be determined by the 15th. It's a big issue. And they've been, in our briefings, they've been putting a lot of work in it, the technical aspects. You raise a really good point. It could reduce costs with regard to where workers are, but it also would be transporting high levels of H2S through the state. Offtake points would have to have a way to clean the gas each place. So there's pros and cons. And you put your finger right on it.
Okay, please continue, Commissioner.
So, Mr. Chairman, sorry this is going on so long here, but we'll try and wrap up rather quickly. But switching gears, and Representative Tarr, you've mentioned this. We also saw in the past year a lot of progress with regard to strategic and critical minerals, what's going on in the mining sector. The governor, a little over a year ago, laid out the strategy that the state's been undertaking. Again, strong legislative support. If you look at that second bullet there, this is the statewide assessment that the legislature funded our Bob Swenson and his team for approximately $3 million, a little under $3 million, working closely with the USGS on this. They're doing great work. You see other elements of this are not dissimilar to the strategy on oil because they're important, whether it's permitting or whether it's getting out and marketing the state. And so what we've had in the past year, you see just continued economic value with regard to the producing mines in Alaska. I think this slide also kind of surprises people. There's a lot of talk about mining in the state, but there's actually only 7 large-scale mines in the state of Alaska. You saw those numbers at the outset. a lot of states like Arizona or Utah or other countries obviously have a lot more than 7. These are all, as you see, producing significant value in terms of Alaska's total exports. But what's also important for this committee to know, and I'm sure many of you have had the opportunity to visit some of these places, is just a huge job engine these are in terms of both the construction but also the operation. I had the opportunity about a year ago to visit Fort Knox, and I think the average number of workers out there is around 700. Average wage in the Alaska mining sector, $100,000. So, as you can imagine, these have enormous impacts you look at Red Dog and the huge impact it has, not only for jobs, but economic and social well-being in the Northwest Arctic Borough. So it's very important to keep that in mind. And then, again, second year in a row, this is the last year we have data on it, but it's not just what's currently happening, but the exploration investment investment in exploration in Alaska, second year in a row that about one-third of total U.S. exploration investment occurred in the state of Alaska. A lot of people think that's just pebble, but it's not just pebble. You look at that second-to-last bullet, it's 30 exploration projects, approximately spent over $1 million in 2011. Again, particularly in the summer season, huge job growth. And one development here that we thought was important, you know, Pebble, obviously, you watch the ads on TV, it's controversial. But the issue is they haven't moved into a permitting phase with DNR or with the federal government yet. They have not applied. What was important since the legislature last met is Donlin Creek, the large gold mine, has moved into the permitting phase. The board of directors approved that move, and we think that that's quite important with regard to that development for the state. And they have we have very high standards they're going to have to meet, but they have moved into that phase. I think they did it this past fall. So. We had our second annual Strategic and Critical Minerals Summit held in Fairbanks. The first one, you see here the governor laid out the statewide strategy. Huge turnout, great national press coverage that we got on that. And then we had it again in Fairbanks. Just I know there was a number of legislators who attended. This was much more focused on putting together partners, whether it's investors, whether it's companies. We had a really good Native corporation participation and presence, private industry, JOGMEC, the Japanese version of ADA, except they have a $45 billion balance sheet about. They came, they were speakers. So again, a lot of excitement at this conference, and we just think it's an indication of getting, you know, 200, 230, 40 people from all over the country, even in this case, other parts of the world, coming to Fairbanks. Fairbanks is a beautiful city, but it was 40, it was 30 below during this conference, and we still had a lot of attendees. And so we're going to continue to do that, and the universities played a really important role in these summits as well. It's a great partnership, and again, we just think we're scratching the surface here. This is a bit of the agenda from the last summit. Gives you kind of a sense of the participants, legislators, business leaders, investors, university officials. Very positive outcome from that.
Representative Wilson has a question.
It's not a question so much as a comment. I went to the first one, and I wasn't able to go to the second one this year. I was just too busy campaigning. But I thought the first one was so outstanding. I learned so much. And I'm sure that the second one was probably better than the first one. So I was just very, very impressed. You did a wonderful job.
Through the chair, thank you, Representative Wilson. The credit goes to Bob Swenson, Elizabeth Blumink, the university. There's a lot of people who put a lot of hours in the work, and it's been in the presenters. As you saw, the first one had great presenters, and so did this one. It was good, quite good.
Representative Seed. Thank you, Mr. Chair. What do we anticipate the effect of the new international treaty on prohibition on mining mercury or use in industrial and mining as far as such as, you know, Donlin Creek was a mercury use for extracting gold, if that's prohibited by international treaty, what's going to be the effect? Have they come out with alternative methods for recovery?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, it's a very good question. I just heard about that. Was that announced like a couple days ago? I don't know the answer.
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, for the record, my name is Ed Fogles. I'm one of the other deputy commissioner of Department of Natural Resources. We're not really that familiar with that treaty, but Donlin won't be using mercury in their process. There will be issues of mercury in the ore that will have to be addressed in the permitting process, in the environmental impact statement, and there are federal and state regulations that would regulate that amount of mercury that potentially may be emitted from that project. But I think that's probably all the information we have on that right now. We can look into that treaty and see if there are any other ramifications and get back to the committee.
Follow up. I guess that was a cyanide process that they were going to use. Is that correct?
Yeah. Through the chair, Representative Seaton. No, Donlin won't be using cyanide either, to my knowledge. They're going to be roasting their ore, oxidizes it, and then there's other procedures to get the gold out.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Any other questions to the committee? Right, please proceed, Commissioner.
So, Mr. Chairman, the other issue, and I know the committee is familiar with this, but as I mentioned, we have had issues the state has, you know, with regard to making our permitting system more timely, efficient, certain. DNR has been we've had our own issues, right? I know this committee is very familiar with the backlog that we had here, 2,500 backlog permits. I do want to mention, and I want to again mention Brent Goodrum, the director of Mining, Land, and Water. We've really made good progress on this issue. And, you know, it's not easy to make progress when it's kind of like repairing an airplane in flight, because you're trying to take care of the backlog. You're getting in a lot more new permits. You're trying to revamp your system, so from a technological standpoint and an efficiency standpoint. And Brent and his team have done a really, really good job. You see some of the numbers. We did get a reduction of almost 40% of that backlog. And we think that we're trying to get it to zero within 3 years. We're certainly on track to do that. And you saw it during the last legislative session, we did make some statutory changes that helped with regard to permitting issues. But as you see on Friday, the governor has introduced a number of other areas that we think are important. Again, the idea here is to not cut corners on environmental protection. We take a lot of pride in how well the state's done in terms of responsibly developing its resources. But we also don't think it should take, 20 years to permit a mine. For example, kind of how you count the numbers, that's what happened with Kensington. So there's a balance, and we're working hard towards that balance. These are some of the other things that we're working on with regard to...
Commissioner, a quick question on the permitting backlog. A couple of years ago, we gave Division of Mining, Land, and Water extra money in the budget, extra people,
yes,
to work through that backlog. When does the department anticipate that you will have worked completely through that backlog to get caught up?
So, Mr. Chairman, our goal was to have it done in 3 years, and we really appreciate support the legislature has given us. Very strong bipartisan support. You mentioned those the additional funding to hire additional people and to fill slots that were vacant in Mining, Land, and Water. We've hired all of the people that were allocated through that funding. We're training them, and it's having an impact. And
was that 3 years from when you started or 3 years from today?
It's 3 years from Brent.
When we started.
Which okay.
Was?
So we're about a year and a half into it.
Right. So a year and a half to go.
Correct.
Okay. Just for our own selfish planning purposes. Representative Wilson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If depending on what's coming up the line here, I know they're working really hard to get caught up on the permitting, but we're going to be seeing more movement there. So are you saying that they'll be caught up in a year and a half and think they'll be able to handle then what's coming up the pike?
Yes.
Woohoo. Great.
Do you anticipate any surplus capacity in a year and a half?
Yeah.
you want to...
And where I'm going with this is kind of the Opump Light direction.
Well, one issue, and we have talked about, I will tell you, we have, you know, we've been frustrated with the federal government on a number of permitting issues that overlap. Point Thompson is a great example. Even though it was state land, that was, the delays were caused by the feds on the permitting, and that cost the state, right? We had agreement from Exxon to have that producing 2 years from this winter, and we had to push that back because of the lost season. But we have been working. One of the things that we've done since the legislature met, we've been working really closely with the Corps. There's a new colonel who's running it, who's very constructive, Colonel Listoki. And, you know, we've even offered up the opportunity to, when they need help, to help them, because a lot of times the problem in terms of overall permitting throughout the state is not, Cook Inlet's a great example, it's not the state slowing things down. It's, you know, a lot of times it can be the feds, and we're working that relationship hard because it's important to get the Corps moving expeditiously.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Ed Fogels again. I would just add that, yeah, at this point, if all goes as planned, we'll knock out that backlog in a year and a half. We have that extra capacity. The plans are to use that extra capacity to shrink our processing time down even further. And how we do that, there are a number of ways we can do that. As you mentioned, the Opump Light model might be one of those ways we could do that. Also, if I could just add one thing, I just do want to, for the record, correct myself. I believe I misspoke. To Representative Seaton's question about cyanide, the Donovan project, I believe, does use cyanide in the mill process, so I apologize for that.
Okay. And Representative Wilson just needs to know the district engineer for Alaska, the new guy?
Colonel Listoki. We can get you his contact info. He's he was very, very helpful on the Point Thompson permitting. Without the feds permitting that in the fall in terms of the record of decision, and we couldn't have done it. The right away by the state, for example, kind of, had they chosen a different right away, we would have had to start all over again on our right away. I mean, it's good cooperation with them right now.
Representative Wilson.
On the topic of backlogs, I've got a question for Joe Balash. How are we doing on the platform abandonments? Are we going to be seeing them out by the end of the session, hopefully?
Through the Chair, Representative Olson, there is drafting underway and reviews. I'm reluctant to commit to a date certain, but I've got a team working on that.
I believe it's been 5 years, but I might be off by a year either way.
So, Mr. Chairman, these are some of the other things that we've been focusing on. And it's not just a DNR effort. I think you see the governor's remarks at the RDC in his focus. This is statewide in terms of what we're trying to do to create more efficiencies in the permitting system. Finally, Mr. Chairman, I did want to just very quickly, we talked a lot about how the state has been out promoting opportunity, targeting, to be honest, certain potential companies to come up here. But wherever we are talking about LNG, either investment or purchasing in Asia, wherever we do that, we always highlight the importance of the meeting what we consider our very high environmental standards here, and essentially telling investors, look, if you're coming up here, you need to have a culture of and a commitment to meet this. We have a strong record in the state, we expect the companies who are new investors here and the current operators to abide by them. These are, you know, a few of many examples that we lay out with these potential companies. These are literally slides that we show them. And then we also highlight the fact that the state in large measure, because of its high standards, has also been a laboratory for innovation in different areas of resource development, where, for example, you look at these slides, a lot of the innovations that have occurred throughout the country and even throughout the world to shrink the footprint of exploration and yet increase the ability in the area underneath the ground to access hydrocarbons. A lot of that has been developed in Alaska. You see here kind of the footprint size of Prudhoe versus, say, for example, Alpine or Liberty, and it's pretty impressive. As it shrunk at the on the surface, it's dramatically expanded below surface in terms of drilling abilities. And then just very quickly, I won't spend much time at all on this, but just legislative session moving ahead. We've talked about it, but we obviously think that the oil tax reform efforts are very critical to the state's efforts. I'm sure you've seen the news, but the U.S. is, by the International Energy Agency, is ranked to be, by 2020, the number one oil producer in the world, the number one gas producer in the world, more than Saudi Arabia, more than Russia, which is amazing. And Alaska needs to be part of that effort, not an anchor on that effort for the United States as a whole. And we certainly have been working hard to implement our comprehensive strategy, but tax reform with regard to that remains key. We hear it from companies all the time. Tremendous resource basin in Alaska, but your costs are too high, and that's that inhibits investment. Heard that quite a lot. And the governor's laid out core principles of tax reform. I'm sure we'll be before this committee getting into details, but I think it's important for him. The point he was making in his press conference, we don't see that the status quo or people without a plan are doing any favors to Alaskans. We think it's unfair to Alaskans, and we think it's unacceptable, and having a declinist view of our future is not where we are. And we certainly hope that we can have a view of optimism. Gas commercialization, as I mentioned, the benchmarks the governor laid out. I think, you know, the broader message is, you know, we need to stop fighting over it and fighting for a gas line, and hopefully that's what we're going to be doing. Permitting reform, as I mentioned, and then we're going to continue to promote the state. We'll be at NAEP in a couple of weeks, have a speaking role there. Different opportunities throughout. We've left you a handout that was in the Oil and Gas Journal. That was a feature on Alaska that the reporter was in town for several weeks. That ran in the Oil and Gas Journal. Evidently 30,000 CEOs in the world get that. And in December, they were all reading about Alaska. So it's one of a number of examples, and we're going to continue to work those issues. So as I mentioned at the outset, we have a lot of cause for optimism. We know there's a lot of work left to do. We're really excited about working with the legislature and other key stakeholders to move the state forward. Thank you very much. You've all been an extremely patient audience. We appreciate the opportunity to have the whole team here to indicate our excitement and desire to work with the legislature during this next session.
Any questions from members? Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, I got a question that's not tagged any of the items you spoke of here. It's kind of a philosophical question I've wanted to ask for a while, and as the former AG in your current position, you might be well positioned to answer it. It concerns Article 8 of the Constitution, which deals with maximum use of resources consistent with public benefit. I think the public hears maximum they hear maximum benefit, and they think maximum short-term revenue. But my question to you is, how does the time element factor into the determination of whether the department is managing our resources for the public benefit? Article 8?
I'm quite familiar with it.
yeah, sure.
But the fact is, we'll be in front of you here through the chair, Representative Sadler. I think it's a very important question, and we see that as it's consistent maximum benefit. We see that as a broad declaration of policy that covers not just short-term thinking, but clearly long-term and future generation thinking. In some ways, that's what we see the oil tax debate about right now. But whether it's economic opportunity that's driven by resource development, whether it's access to the state's lands,
whether it's conservation. A huge part of what DNR does works on conservation with regard to state parks and other areas. We think that the idea of public interest that's stated in the Constitution is important, but I do want to say it also relates to using our resources, whether it's using them for enjoyment, getting to our amazing state parks, or for the benefit of communities. Again, Red Dog is a great example of a part of the state that's used resources not only for jobs but whole social programs that have been built around some of the revenue that have come from that development. So we see that broadly, but as you may have seen last year, there's a little controversy when we tried to define our mission more along the lines of the constitutional mandate. But as I explained, and be glad to do it again in an op-ed, some people took that as, oh, that's short-term, that's only for, and that was a misreading or maybe a misunderstanding, maybe we didn't articulate it well. But we see that broadly covering a number of areas, and certainly a number of generations.
Thank you. Any other questions from committee members? The commissioner just on a...
One?
Representative Seaton.
Thank you. On slide 55, you have Liberty as 2012 and a footprint there. That rig has been sold, right?
No, I think that's a typo.
So
I apologize for
that's
that.
No longer on the table. Is that correct?
Through the chair, we can get back on that, but that's a mistake.
Okay. Any other questions for me? Great. Commissioner, I'd just like to bring out one point. 2 years ago, one of the main issues that was brought to my attention was the attention that the commissioner's office was paying to agriculture. And I'd like to commend you and your staff, specifically you and Mr. Fogles, for really raising the bar on that, and certainly paying attention to agriculture. I think we've made a lot of headway over the years, or last 2 years, and I think the farmers are certainly noticing that, and look forward to some continued developments in that arena, as well as all this oil, gas, minerals, et cetera.
Mr. Chairman, just real quick on that, thank you. As you know, any kind of overview like this, you always run the risk of not talking about certain areas. That is an area that I want to thank, and Ed Fogles and Francie have done a great job, and we have more work to do there, but it's a great community, the ag community. It's hard workers, it's salt of the earth, innovative people who have been really contributing not only to the economy of the state but the food security of Alaskans. And the more we can get Alaskans to recognize that, go to the store, buy Alaska grown products, go to restaurants, ask for it, it benefits all of us. And we've been trying to beat that drum pretty hard, and we're going to beat it harder, but it's been actually a lot of we've enjoyed working with the farm community quite a lot.
Yeah, we appreciate it. Commissioner, your deputies, all the division heads that came down, thanks very much. We got through quite a stack of slides in probably record time. My thanks to members of the committee for keeping your questions pertinent and to the point. We will meet again Wednesday and hear from the Department of Environmental Conservation. And we had allocated time for you, but I guess you can go. Get back to work.
I think we've spoken long enough, so appreciate the opportunity. Thank you.
Okay, with that, we adjourn.